Welcome to Emotional Sobriety. We've been dealing with some fires here on the West Coast. Of course, Alan's in Pennsylvania area, but he's got roots here in California. People fleeing their homes, people losing their homes. There's been animals fleeing. You know, I've had to relocate some loved ones. Thankfully, I didn't lose anything myself in the fires. There's been ash, there's been smoke, 24/7 terror coming through the news that we've all been watching and hoping that we're not next. We thought we'd talk about emotional sobriety and in the face of very real environmental calamity that we're all facing. Am I kind of capturing it, Alan?
As we sit here, you know, you're right in the midst of it being in Southern California. I was a few years ago, I had to evacuate my home in Westlake. So I have some sense of the anxiety and fear that comes over you when you realize that a fire is encroaching on your property and on your life and endangering, you know, everything that you hold near and dear to you. And so we want to first take a minute and just recognize the incredible catastrophe that's occurring to those people that have been facing this and dealing with this in Southern California. And then, of course, you know, it's always with a crisis like this, we see both sides of human nature. We see some incredible acts of love and concern and mobilizing, people mobilizing themselves to help others that are really in dire need. And then on the other hand, we have people going around starting fires so people have to evacuate so they can enter their homes and loot them. And, you know, it just shows us the range, you know, of human nature. You know, Scott Peck called those people of the lie that are just out to take advantage of a situation and without any regard for anyone else and what they're doing to other people. And it's a very dark side of human nature. And yet here it is right in our face again.
The profiteers on the back end of the fire, you know, there's the insurance companies that don't want to make payouts. There's the real estate companies that they're looking to gouge and buy up the land in bulk after the people have lost their homes. And, you know, that's a form of looting and that's a form of kind of, profiting over human misery. That's really, really like that's what cuts me when I think about this, or that's one of the things that cut me when as we experience this. So on top of that, not to get too negative, but yeah.
No, but it's see, this is part of if we define emotional sobriety as having an honest and the appropriate relationship to reality, these are the things that we have to face. And we have to, you know, protect ourselves from some of these things. And you know, it's unfortunate that that's the case, but it's the reality of the thing. And you're right. There's going to be people stepping in after this that's going to be taking advantage. We saw it in COVID, didn't we, Patrick? I mean, so many people were taken advantage of with being sold that here's something that will prevent COVID from happening and making, you know, lots of money off of bogus, you know, health, you know, related products that are going to protect people from getting the COVID, you know, without encouraging people to get vaccinated. I mean, it's a real dark side of human nature, but it is the reality of it, you know, but there's people out there. And so just to try to, you know, bring some reality to this situation. In every crisis, you're going to see both of these things happen at not only at the social level, but also inside of us. Right. We're going to struggle. There's going to be a part of us that's going to really respond and try to do the best we can. And then there could be a part of us, another part of us that does something similar to the looting, right? Is that we don't respond from the best in us to deal with the situation. And we get upset and angry and start to make demands. And there's going to be a lot of this, Patrick. You know, the recovery from something like this, they're estimating is going to be 10 years.
Yeah, so I was wondering about the Olympics. There was going to be the Olympics in L.A., I believe, in 2026 or 2028, maybe. That seems like it's probably not happening, at least at this point.
Well, it may. I mean, it just depends. I mean, look, I don't ever want to underestimate, you know, what an amazing people that we are in America, because we can really rise up and meet a challenge. And, you know, look at what we did in World War II. It was pretty phenomenal. The production that ended up, you know, we won the war just because of our industrial might in many ways, and also because, you know, we had a great, great military force that was very brave and courageous in the face of a lot of danger. But, you know, we'll rise up. We'll deal with this thing, you know, because we have to. And it's not going to happen in, you know, the way that any of us want it to. And, you know, I think that's the first thing that I wanted to mention today is in this situation, you know, we're going to have to really be careful of, you know, checking our expectations and not setting ourselves up for things to happen in the way that we'd like them to, because we're in a lot of pain and we're anxious about it. You know, hopefully that's not the case. Hopefully things will turn out the way that you need them to, if you're facing a loss and you're filing claims and that people are going to be responsive. I did get some encouraging news from somebody that's in the insurance industry, is they're already mobilizing and getting ready to write a lot of checks and not even needing to send adjusters to the area, because all they got to do is take a picture to see what's happened. Right? These homes have been flat.
Yeah, yeah. What do you need to investigate, right? It's all
there's
in the news.
No,
yeah.
There's no adjuster going out to see what extended the damage is on your car when your car blew up in the driveway because the heat was so great, right? And your gas tank went up and the whole car blown up. So not only addition, I mean, just think about all the homes that are destroyed and then all the vehicles that have been destroyed in this. I mean, it's boggling. And then if you owned a business in that area, I mean, my God, man, first of all, you know, from all of us here, you know, that in the podcast, we really send our love and concern and prayers out to you that you'll be able to find a way to work yourself through this thing and take care of yourself as best you can. And that's the other thing is give yourself a lot of room to not do anything perfectly here. You know, when we're in a crisis like this, you know, we will try to have the best response, and it's not always going to be best because there's going to be a lot of fear and anger and blaming and all of that stuff that goes on, that if someone would have done this, we might not have faced this. But, you know, I think of that blaming as taking away the energy from coping. Because as soon as I'm focused on what somebody should have done, I'm not paying attention to what I need to do. When I'm focused on what somebody should be doing, then I am draining energy from what I need to be doing to best address the situation as it is. And, you know, Fritz Perl said a very interesting thing, Patrick, and I used to struggle with this when I first heard it. But as more and more I've gotten into emotional sobriety, I just see his wisdom in it. He said, when you let the situation you're in control you, and you find the best response given the parameters of that situation you're in, he says, then you start to grow. Then you start to mature because you're now, in our language, you're now coping with life as it is. That's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, in emotional sobriety, is for us to learn to deal with what's ever in front of us and not get lost in all the shoulds that would so easily emerge from the, you know, the ashes of this fire.
I've been hearing that the turnout of volunteering, you know, donations and, you know, all kinds of like action being taken, at least, you know, LA locals to try and help those that have been displaced. I mean, I hear that there's just been overwhelming response along those lines. To me, it seems like there's no better way to really deal with something like this than to try and find some way to put your hands on it.
I've known many people that have opened up their homes to people that have lost their homes and helping them make that transition in terms of what life is going to look like next for these families. And so you're right, man. The Angelenos are stepping up. And listen, and all across the country, there's concern. You know, this is maybe one of the greatest natural disasters, at least in our times, that anyone's had to face in any city. And it rivals what happened in the hurricanes and the flooding down in New Orleans and the hurricanes and the destruction in Florida. It's mind numbing to look at the magnitude. You know, they're estimating, Patrick, over $150 billion of damage.
It wouldn't surprise me if it was more. And what this event is reminding me is that displaced people, impoverished people all over the world, when people are wreathed in flames, you know, we all look basically the same. I think in California, there's a kind of perception that we're kind of like above the fray. It's the most liberal coded state in the United States. But we're just as susceptible to climate change as any of these other places. No place is safe. We're all going to be dealing with this. There needs to be a collective response. It's hard for me to get around the blame thing, you know, at least from where I'm sitting. I saw a clip from Speaker Johnson talking about conditioning federal aid. The money spigot doesn't turn on from the top. That's the blame side of me. And then the service focused and the more kind of, you know, positive action focused is, you know, I got some groceries for somebody who lost their house. And I think that the groceries for the person who lost their house made me feel better. The blame is just kind of like a, you know, a snake swallowing its own tail.
As we just talked about, people are going to use this instead of dealing with the problem. They're going to try to use this for political advantage, right? For political gains. And people will try to, you know, disparage in terms of how it's dealt with. But, you know, it's once again, see, in emotional sobriety, if someone spills the milk, we don't get focused on who spilled the milk. We focus first on cleaning it up. And then we can sit and try to learn what we might be able to do better to deal with or even prevent a situation like this. But during a time when we're in the middle of the crisis, to be critical is not helping anybody.
You know what I found out? What I found out about myself.
Except it's serving, right? Someone's self-centeredness and selfishness.
Yeah, I was so scared that first week, which was, I suppose, last week. We recorded an episode of the podcast right at the beginning. I mean, we touched on it a little bit at the beginning of the episode. When you listen, you'll hear it. But I had no idea how big this was going to be. I tend to post a lot through my mental anguish about different political things. For the first week of this, what I noticed is that I wasn't posting at all. I was helping people pack their suitcases. My girlfriend, Sue Ann, I drove her from Culver City to Irvine because there was smoke in the air and the sky looked awful. And I wasn't sure how deep in LA this thing was going to spread. When you hit that place of real fear, or I'll speak for myself, when I hit that place of real fear, I wasn't expressing opinions. I was just trying to figure out, do I need to really like mobilize in a way I never have before to get to high ground?
It's taking care of business, man. Do what's the next indicated step to be safe, right? We can worry about these other things after that. But the first step is to really be safe. And you were right on, man.
All I managed to do is just how much am I safe right now where I'm standing today? And can I put the fear, the existential fear on the shelf for like another 24 hours? And yeah, there's been enough, I guess, like there's been enough positive news there has not been positive news. Let me amend that. But there's been less Chicken Little, the sky's falling these last couple days that has allowed me to more easily put that fear on the shelf and to kind of, I'm working on a independent movie right now in Northern California. So my loved ones are safe back home and I'm out of town. I've got an app that kind of tells me about the different fires that are raging. I steal looks at it every now and then, kind of try to decode what's happening. And I always hope that we're past the worst of it. Yeah, like you said, I mean, when they finally tally the devastation, it's going to be, it's the biggest fire in Los Angeles history, I believe, maybe California history. I left a message on somebody's voicemail the other day. You know, I really don't like living through history. And yeah, that's it. That's what it seems like we're living through history right now. I first noticed this dynamic when Sandy Hook happened. There was this there was a mass shooting. When I talked to my therapist about it, he told me that every single one of his clients, like, you know, he has many clients over the course of the day, and each of them that was the conversation. Everybody was experiencing it, even though none of them had children, you know, that had attended the school themselves. They were touched by it. People really do kind of have this empathic hive mind. Has there been any like thing that you've noticed, I guess, in kind of navigating this issue with different people at this time? I mean, does it just kind of confirm, you know, for you, the kind of the basic goodness and, you know, the fellow feeling of others?
You know, it confirms the unbelievable altruism that exists inside of us, which is such a beautiful thing. And it also shows me the dark side in human nature. And, you know, being a psychotherapist, I end up, you know, facing and seeing a lot of that at a lot of different levels. And, you know, in this kind of situation is going to bring out the best of us and the worst of us. And once again, I think the most important thing is to not get too lost in what everybody's doing and to see what we can do to be able to add, to be able to help in this situation and not subtract, not cause any other fires in any other way, but to see what we can do to help deal with this thing. And the path through this is going to be with empathy. Everybody's going to be doing the best they can. And so if you're dealing with someone and they're not responding as quickly as you want, if you add some empathy to that, it's going to go a long way. Anything that I've said is not to erase your experience. If you're furious about this, be furious about it. And if you scream and shout long enough, you'll get to the other part where you just start crying. Because, you know, one way we heal loss is through our grief and through really allowing ourselves to feel the pain of that loss. And if we process it right, then we recover at least the parts of ourselves that were lost in this fire. We may not recover some of the worldly possessions that had incredible sentimental value, but you can recover the parts of you that got lost.
I'm Josh, and I'm from Lawndale, California.
What's your experience been like of the fire so far?
Well, it's more my mother-in-law's experience than mine by proxy with hers. It was awful, man. She was out, and when she got the call, and she wasn't far, she was just out. And it seems like they had the barricades up much sooner than they had a response to the active fires. And she could not get back into her home in the Palisades. She lived in the Tahitian Terrace, a mobile home park. And my wife raced over there to try to get to the cat who was inside the home. And she made it to the barricade on Temescal, and she could not make it through. They would not let her in. And then she narrowly escaped that mass car abandonment and the other people who got trapped on Sunset. The fire was literally over her shoulder. She was sending me messages, and I was on standby with an e-bike ready to penetrate as deeply as I could before I was stopped. And then my plan was to just get her on the bike and jog myself out. And but she missed that the fire rolling over Sunset by about 20 minutes. It was too close a shave. It was really dicey. And my mother-in-law sadly lost everything from she's European, so everything from her parents from France, and you know, it's just a bummer. All of her art that she'd done since she was a little girl. She grew up an artist. She had a studio that was like a shed. She called the studio. And of course my wife lost everything, from her childhood as well. And it's just been awful. It's been an awful situation. We're all resilient people, but awful. And now the household's flavor is one of anger, the gross mismanagement of this. Everyone knew it was coming, and to hear it's just, there was a lot that could have been done that wasn't. And I certainly hope that citizenry perks their ears up and realizes that these politicians and giant bureaucracies are not necessarily their friend when it comes to accomplishing goals and votes differently. That's my hope.
Yeah, mine too, more or less. So that's been the emotional climate, and the aftermath has just been a lot of anger.
Awful, you know, and all I could do was just hold her when there was an opportunity to hold her, because my wife was doing most of the holding and hold both of them. And bring water and bring tissues. And she was just writhing on our couch saying, I have lost everything in French over and over again. Everything is gone. It's all gone. The cat, it's all gone. And just, you know, it was a sobering event in which everything shrinks and you realize all the stuff you're busy thinking matters actually doesn't.
I remember when COVID happened and I went on a Zoom meeting that you were on. And, you know, on the podcast, we talk a lot about unenforceable rules and unrealistic expectations. And you were talking during COVID about how our expectation that the trains were going to run on time and that the trash man was going to come and grab our trash, which had been kind of this immovable or kind of like, you know, as natural an expectation as the sun's going to come up tomorrow, is not, now we can't really set our clocks to that anymore. And with the fires now as well, there's just this been this kind of progression of things that we took for granted that we can no longer take for granted.
Well, evidently it's God's will, you know, nature runs a certain way. And one of the ways it cleans itself and picks its scabs is through fire. And there are certain mitigations that could be, you know, brush clearing, for instance, or hydrant maintenance, for instance, or maybe tax dollars getting funneled to the appropriate things we voted for in the form of reservoirs, for instance. But ultimately, you're left with the way things are. And so what AA taught me is, you launch into action. That's all you really have available. So immediately I was fortunate enough to have I bought the home that I'm in now, with existing violations, and AA taught me to make friends. Right. And so I made friends with the city. And so they have been a little lax on enforcing upon me or giving me time to get my things together. Nothing nefarious is going on, but they're not necessarily treating me like an enemy, which is a nice change of pace from a majority of my life. And so I had plans that were already there. So I'm fortunate enough to have a garage that was converted into an accessory room that has an additional bathroom, but it's not insulated. There's rafters as a garage in the main room. I mean, you can't live in it during winter. It's 38 degrees in there at night. And everything goes out of the hole where the whirly bird turns. But I just asked the city manager, given my mother's situation, can I adjust these plans and get an ADU permit pulled so I could try to create somewhere for her to live? And they said they'd help me streamline it. You know, when you ask for help, people generally will try to give it to you. If you demand help, they don't give it to you so often. But you know, AA taught me to use honey instead of vinegar whenever possible and to just try to practice kindness whenever possible and to tell the truth. And I have a very blunt way of telling the truth, as you know, personally. So I launched into action and I immediately went to the store to pick her up the necessities that she needed. And I told everyone what had happened and people, the community gathered and people dropped off donations of clothes, asked me her size. I've got a whole back room filled with clothes. And what we got to do is the stuff that she couldn't use, we got to go drop back off at the evacuation center so other people could take a swing at it. And, you know, I pulled out the blower that morning and blew the ash off everything. And you just get to work. You know, there's an adage that's not so prevalent in AA these days, which is, you know, you will find a helping hand at the end of your own damn wrist. and so whenever I can take action, I try. There's certain things I like to think of my higher power as like a physical law. Things can either be or they can't. It's like a structural engineering. You can try to build something in your life, but whether or not it stands is really up to the physical laws at play. And so some relationships will only last a few months. Some relationships will last a lifetime. Some businesses will only last a few clients. Some will be sold successfully and scale. Like But you don't, the only problem is, as apes, we don't know which is which. And so it's our job, my job, to dream big and to use spiritual principles to guide that dream. Is this good for me? Is this good for everyone else around me? Is this good for my community? Is this good for humanity? And if I can kind of check those boxes when I'm making decisions, I can dream as big as I want and then see whether or not God allows that thing I'm dreaming and trying to work towards to be either lawful or unlawful. And so that's what I do. What do I want? I want a place for my parents-in-law to live. That's not on top of me and my wife. And so let's try to see if we can do it. So I called the contractor, I called the planning people, I called the stuff, all while running a business, all while sponsoring a lot of guys. You just do it. And I think there's this weird thing in our minds that you think that it's the same allotment of time and expenditure of time. You get a certain amount of limited seconds of consciousness per day. And this idea that reserving them to sit and do nothing is somehow better or more less painful than allocating them in the purpose of doing something. It is the same expenditure. It's the same cost to do things versus to sit and do no things. I'm just going to go until I'm tired. And when I'm tired, I'm going to sleep. Or I'm just going to go until I'm hungry. And when I'm hungry, I'm going to eat. And then you just surrender to the thing in front of you. And if you learn how to listen and you grow spiritually and you elevate your consciousness and you attempt to continue to self-sacrifice through work.
I bet you weren't expecting for those resources to be allocated in quite this way so early in the new year.
Oh, man. No, but that just goes to show you that's what I get for thinking. We've never had control, you know, and like nothing up until this point in our life. What happens, I think, is you get sober for a while. And you think, now I've really got a handle on stuff. And so because of that, I know where I'm going. Thanks, God. I got this. And it's highly sensible. And it's, most logical. And, you know, you give it to a chain of people in a TED Talk and they'll applaud you at the end. But then you just forget that I had zero control over where I'm sitting now. Everything in my life has been just, it's sudden. It's just there, the opportunity is there. And you walk into the opportunity and you do what's next in the opportunity. And suddenly you've got a job, or suddenly you've got a girlfriend. And then suddenly that girlfriend's your wife. And then suddenly you're walking your dog one day and you go right, literally, instead of left, and there's a for sale sign and you have no interest in buying a house. You're not pre-approved. You haven't even been looking on the market. You just call because it's got a really good lot size and you think that would be wonderful for the dogs. And it's right by where I walk them. Let's see, who knows? No one, if the termite stopped holding hands, the damn thing would have fallen down. But I happened to be a weirdo who had a history in flipping houses in my late 20s. I lost a significant amount of money and had a come to God moment in my 10 years of sobriety of losing everything, including the girl, within a 2-week period, and getting put into a bankruptcy level debt that I ended up getting to pay off with the help of other people. And I didn't have to declare bankruptcy. And so here I am with clean credit as a result of AA, walking my dog. Here's a place. I had my offer in by Sunday night, and I had a pre-approval by Tuesday and then here we are. It's wild. And that's the result of just taking action. So I don't know what's waiting for all the people who've gone through this incredible tragedy. It's awful. I'm so pissed. My heart is breaking for everyone. And I know what's going to happen. Land speculators got their eye on it. Insurance companies are going to pay out the bottom dollar. The local market rate is going to get inflated. All the building materials are going to become five times as much. And then at the end of the day, people who are a little bit more powerful are going to get a hold of something they didn't have a hold of. And they've destabilized an entire community that had a very strong opinion when it came to what they would or wouldn't put up with in this town. And so now, you know, you can see the powers of play at work, but it's hard. It's like, what do you do? Like what you do is you do your best that you can to insulate your family. You take care of your community. You try to be a good person. You try to tell the truth. And if someone asks you your opinion on what's happening, you tell them, you know. But it's beyond that. You just have to, it's America. We have to, you know, you vote the way you think. You vote with your dollar. If you don't vote in the ballots, you know, you vote, you just, you make the declaration of how you live, the opinion of how you feel. And where we run into trouble is when those two things don't match up. Here I am in AA saying a whole bunch of BS, blowing hot wind like the Hindenburg, you know, and you watch the way I live and I'm yelling at my wife and I'm not paying my bills on time and my bed is not made and my house is in disarray and there's 1,000 things I'm pursued and I wake up anxious. But when I talk, I sound real good, you know? So it's like, it's about aligning everything and just trying to make it really simple. If spiritual principles are the way I'm supposed to live, then pony up. I made a vow when I married my wife. I did not think that the card would get called that soon of to show up this way. Literally October 12th of this year, me and the wife got hitched. So like, and then all of a sudden mama's here. But
I guess you meant it.
Yeah. What choice is there? It to not help presumes that doing that would be easier and better. It's like when someone says, how can you be patient or how can you be loving? That almost presupposes the idea that being unloving or impatient is a better way to live that's more mm-hmm. rewarding. Like oftentimes doing the right thing is the easier thing to do for all parties. And so that's this whole practicing the principles and all your affairs thing, you know? I certainly feel vastly underqualified for everything I find myself in the midst of today. But God put me here, so I got to trust that. And I just do the next right thing, you know?
How you doing?
I'm all right, man. Are you kidding? I was raised by wolves.
You seem good.
Yeah. I mean, God uses garbage to make flowers. I had an event when I first moved in here and with a run-in on an unsavory character. And let's just that my life was threatened on the railroad tracks. And I probably approached the situation way too hot-blooded, thinking I was John Dutton now that I own a piece of land. And the guy pulled a gun on me. And this was early on. And he wasn't from our neighborhood. He was here doing drugs somewhere, wandered in. And he threatened to kill me and my dogs. And I found myself in a type of standoff. And cops came. And it was gnarly. And I didn't sleep well following that. And I just always felt more comfortable on the couch instead of in my bed so that I could keep an eye on things, because that's just the kind of guy I am. And as a result, I was sleeping less and less. And then it was the AC was out, so I couldn't, it was too hot in the room and I needed to be cool. But ultimately, I wasn't sleeping with my wife in the same bed. And I got my little selfish time at night. I could look at whatever I wanted to on my phone. I could listen to whatever podcast I wanted to, right? And then through this, we have people in the house. I was right back in bed and I'm finding that I sleep well in bed and that it's so nice to be next to my wife in bed. So there's silver linings like that. Like all of a sudden we want to have a family, we want to have kids, but we're both only children. And now we're living with other people and their personalities, and it's perfect emotional preparation for having to take care of a child and share your space with a new being. And so, you know, everything, cataclysm is a chaos is a ladder, right? To quote Littlefinger from Game of Thrones. So like, chaos is a ladder. And I'm real grateful that I grew up so the way I did, because, you know, we're able, the first thing I did too, Patrick, is I went and bought 100-foot stainless steel garden hoses and 4,800 square feet sprayers that have telescopic legs on them that I could put onto my roofs in the case that we find ourselves in this situation. So, you know, AA taught me you just get into action. And of course I'm sad, but the hardest part of all of this on it, quite honestly, is trying not to make it about me.
Yeah.
That's the hardest part. My house, my privacy, my space, my, like, as if I earned any of it. Like, I'm just a lucky fool and I've been given God's grace. And so I know how if we truly know how lucky we are, we spend more of our time giving it away to other people. And the luck keeps growing. You know, call it grace, call it whatever you want to call it, but I just don't have any control. But I'm but living in this with this way of life is sobriety. Recovery is like sailing, and sailing is very hard work. Ask any sailor. I don't know if you've ever sailed, but you need a team to do it. You need collaboration. It's physically taxing. But what you have control over your crew, you have control over your lines, you have control over your sails and your vessel. But what you don't have control over is the wind.
Yeah, and the water. Yeah.
And the water. You need those two things, and those are beyond your control. You can meet the wind and water conditions with all of those agencies you have at your behest. But beyond that, it's really up to nature.
My name is Danny B. I'm originally from San Pedro, California, but I live now in Huntington Beach. I went to school at UCLA, where the evacuation zone basically abutted against. And so, you know, I spent much of my early adult life in and around Westwood. And so the West Side's always been close to me. You know, I lived there for a few years. And I spent a lot of time at the Pacific Palisades Women's Club for meetings. I spent a lot of time in that Gelson's that burned down. You know, it's just, it's pretty crazy to think that, you know, this place that I spent like over a decade with now exists only in my mind and no longer, you know, in the real world.
When the news started coming through, I think I remember you telling me, like, because you have a new baby and then one firstborn.
I think it was the middle of the night that I was up for like the 2 a.m. feeding or something like that, you know, balancing the phone on my knee while feeding the baby and, you know, seeing the fire sweeping through and it just, and where they were going. And I'm like, oh my God, it's like, it's gone. The Palisades are just gone, you know, and that just was really, really devastating. And it kind of took a while. And then when I saw the videos the next day of moon shadows in Malibu, where I had my first day with my wife, that it had burned down and just had like a blue flame, probably out of a ruptured gas valve, and just the pylons there on or off of PCH in Malibu. Like I cried a little bit. I was just in so much shock. Yeah.
You'd like to go to a meeting in the Palisades. Is that meeting place gone as well?
They still obviously can't have meetings for a while, but I mean, for somehow it survived. The Self-Realization Fellowship, Lake Shrine, also survived apparently. So that's really good because I had never been there before. I always wanted to go. That's where Yogananda had established.
Yeah, I felt definitely like a pang of melancholy because you had told me that the meeting to find you at would be the Palisades in just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And then I guess our plan had to change for that.
Yeah, because that's where I could drop off my son with my mom in San Pedro, pick up, you know, another person in recovery who lived nearby and head up there. I had this whole plan figured out. And then now that plan is kaput.
When COVID happened, I was about a year sober. So I was pretty new. You know, you'd been, you know, doing this a while, you know, 12 steps, groups and fellowship. But like, I did feel kind of like there was a paradigm shift in how the world changed with that. And kind of like, and I realized that my recovery had to expand to like, you know, I had to put my recovery to work a little bit harder to cope with the ground shifting beneath my feet. And now, you know, with climate change, we're adding more and more layers, you know, to that idea of, you know, we've got to lean into the spirit. We've got to lean into the mind to get through some really, you know, some this existential period. And like, what is your understanding of that been, or like how has it changed, you know, over these last few years? Is there anything new you're adding, or have you keyed in anything that you, any understanding that you didn't have when you first got in?
I'm one always trying to seek to return to the basics. I don't think there's much new in this world to discover. You know, I mean, it was only what, 6 years after Bill and Bob first met, you had Pearl Harbor breakout. So it's not the first time like crazy things have happened in the world during with people in recovery, right? So it's common. You know, I have a lot of respect for you for getting sober during the pandemic, because I, for me, I'm just such a tactile person. Like I really need to be in person around real people. I never was able to get the same effect from Zoom meetings that I had while in person. So, you know, I think that would have been really difficult for me to get through that. I don't know. I have to be in person. And as time goes on, like it's been, if I make it another month, it'll be 14 years of sobriety. And I just, you know, I just try to keep, I think about what I did the first, you know, 9 months of sobriety. And I just try to keep doing that. It really isn't about like adding anything new. You know, it's about not losing the things that I was doing that keep me sober, right? Going to meetings. I need to be consistently going to meetings. That's also very difficult when you have kids, right? So, you know, trying to make sure, like really put a lot of effort into planning and negotiations with my wife and family. Like, how am I going to get to a meeting, right? That's the main thing. And I have a very full life now. You know, when I got into recovery, I was a college dropout, had no job. I had nothing better to do. And you know what? I went to 13 meetings a week and it was fantastic. And I got so much recovery from that. And I would meditate on the beach every day and go on runs. I was really good. And now I have a beautiful, full life. I have, you know, an extremely busy, you know, very stressful job in the biotech industry. And I have two very small children. And there's like so much to fill my life that it's very easy to come up with an excuse to not do those things which keep me sober, right? To not reach out to other alcoholics, to not pick up the phone when a sponsee calls me, to not go to at least one meeting a week, but you know, ideally two, three, right? To not try to reach out to newcomers and sponsor new people, to, you know, to meditate, to call my sponsor. It's very, very easy because I'm so busy not to do those things. So there, like I said, there's nothing new that I need to be doing. I just have to not lose the things that I was doing that kept me sober this long.
I can't help but wonder if it had been my house that was lost, you know, if I had been hit in a much more direct and damaging way by the climate change crisis, you know, would I then take that as my excuse to stop practicing, you know, my recovery practice? And I hope not, because it's a matter of life and death for me. But I don't know, like events like this just make me wonder, you know, how deep do those roots go, or what am I really made of, you know, because I see what some people go through and it's just boggles the mind, you know. I don't know how people cope with it.
Well, you do what you got to do, you know. I think, and well, it's interesting too, like I'm the kind of person, and I've noticed, I highly would recommend this book. If there's anyone else in recovery who likes history, this book, Grant, by Ron Chernow. He's the same author that wrote the Hamilton biography that the play was based off of. And I relate so much to Ulysses S. Grant. You know, he was a horrifying alcoholic.
Yeah, that part of it, for sure.
You know, really smart. He was, And you know, during the Mexican-American War, where he was an officer, you know, he did all these valorous feats of bravery, you know, like riding along the side of his horse through gunfire and cannon fire to get more ammunition when he was an officer and didn't have to do that. And, you know, and then he would go through these long stretches where when nothing crazy was going on, he would just start drinking and lose everything, get kicked out of the army. You know, he could hardly hold together a job or make any money. Like before the Civil War, he was selling piles of logs on the street corner to make money. and then the Civil War starts. He joins, you know, he signs up, gets reactivated, and immediately starts becoming this amazing, stellar, brilliant tactician general. But during any lulls, he was off and on a bender again. And I kind of relate to that. Like when things are going crazy, like, and the world is chaotic, I feel sharp and focused and I'm not stressed, you know, because the way my sickness works is I am just hyper vigilant all the time, right? Hyper vigilant. You know, always anxious, always in fight or flight, right? That's my problem. I have to like try to calm my mind and my body during normal times and tell myself that like things are okay. You know, that's a difficulty. And then, and part of like drinking and using was to escape, right? And to be able to relax because I can't, you know, but during times when there is an actual emergency, like it's like, oh, okay. Like all of my anxiety that I live with all the time actually has a purpose to direct it to, right? And then I become highly effective. And then once things get sort of calm again, that's when I would, you know, go crazy and drink and start to screw up my life.
You're plenty busy right now. So in a sense, that's now you're locked in because there's no other option really.
Yeah, totally. And I'm fine with that. You know, I'm not like I get no more than like an hour straight of sleep per night. And, you know, every day is chaotic and really busy and crazy.
But you seem chipper.
Yeah, I'm fine. You know, I'm fine. Like, whatever. Like, it is like, that's life, you know, and it's beautiful and it's amazing. And I took my youngest baby to the doctor today and he had a good checkup. So I'm just like, you know, I'm just grateful things are okay. Like, things could always be significantly worse.
Any advice to those, I don't know, those suffering, those a little out over their skis because of, you know, the calamity?
Yeah, I mean, just try to step back and look at the big picture. You know, like there's suffering, like there's no joy without suffering, right? It's like the yin and yang of everything. Like Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, no mud, no lotus. Like we have to have all of these, you know, the thousand terrible tragedies and the thousand beautiful joys of life. That is, you know, what it is. And it's only in relation that we can actually live this. And, you know, when I find myself strained, I pray like crazy. You know, and only by having this consistent feedback and input to a higher power do I just sort of, you know, skate by another day, because it's, you know, it's really scary and I have very little faith in myself to be able to accomplish all of the thousand things that I need to do. And, you know, there's a hundred things to worry about. And so I have to pray, you know, it's the only way I survive. So I would recommend doing that.
All right. Well, I'll be the first one to try and incorporate a little more of that. And audience, this is my sponsor. So just so we all know. Yeah, he's a good dude. Well, thanks for joining us. And I just felt like I needed some, you know, some extra guns this week because it's a kind of a rough time. And, you know, I wanted to make sure, you know, we had a nice full episode with some like rich, you know, varying perspectives to give people during a time like this. So thanks for joining us.
Tend your life, tend your myth, cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.